From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
On the panel this week, Michael Warren, joining us for the first time from the Weekly Standard, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is the White House correspondent for West Wing Reports, Paul Brandes.
Hello, thank you for joining us, and here are the issues. The head of America's CIA has made a secret trip to North Korea for talks with its leader, Kim Jong-un. Cuba has a new leader, and for the first time in six decades, his last name is not Castro. The former director of the FBI, the U.S. government's law enforcement organization, continues a very public and very nasty spat with President Trump. And Barbara Bush has passed away. The former first lady was the wife of one president and the mother of another. We'll talk about her life and legacy. Well, let's start with North Korea. A lot of intriguing developments of late as this meeting between its leader, Kim Jong-un, and President Trump shapes up. Among the developments, a secret visit to Pyongyang, that's the North Korean capital, by Mike Pompeo. He, of course, is the director of the CIA and nominee to be the next Secretary of State. Michael Warren of the Weekly Standard joins us for the first time. Michael, welcome. Let's start with you. This meeting between Pompeo and Kim, how did it go?
Well, it seems to have not gone badly because the administration is still talking about the likelihood of a presidential meeting between President Trump and Kim. The CIA and sort of intelligence is really how we have maintained contact in back channels with the North Koreans. So it sort of makes sense that the CIA director might try to broker this meeting. But of course, he's also got this nomination as to be Secretary of State in the administration. And the administration and its allies are really pushing in sort of the public sphere here, and as well as with Democrats in Congress who are resisting Pompeo's nomination, that this visit shows he is very much not the bellicose person that Democrats have been portraying him as, but even he's willing to be diplomatic and go out of his way to be a big part of this effort to seek diplomacy with North Koreans. They're making this pitch. We'll see if it actually ends up working and convincing some Democrats. But I think it's a big step and suggests more to come on this potential summit.
Tom, there was a very significant development just in the past couple of days. The North Korean leader, apparently, this is what the South Korean President Moon says. North Korea has not confirmed it. But apparently, Kim Jong-un has said that he is willing to drop their long-standing pledge that American troops have to leave the Korean Peninsula before any serious talks can happen. Potentially quite significant.
Absolutely, Paul, because the U.S. military has been there since the Korean War. And more to the point, perhaps, the U.S. has just finished building a massive base away from Seoul, and therefore away from the reach of North Korean artillery. And the notion that the U.S. would walk away after doing this and pulling out 28,500 American troops is nonsensical, and I think Kim knows that. And so, of course, the question is, the devil is always in the details. If this is true, that is very significant development, but what would he want? And I'm sure Kim would want in exchange for this some security guarantees. But I think this is a promising development. And it sounds to me like everybody thinks, including President Trump, that there will be a meeting and it might go better than most people would expect. We'll see.
Well, the way these kind of high stakes, high drama things go is if you go in and, leave without some kind of major agreement, it's perceived at least as a flop. So he's got to make sure that there's going to be some kind of good outcome before he even goes in. For the U.S., what might that outcome be? What does President Trump want?
Well, he wants denuclearization of North Korea. And I'm skeptical that he's going to be able to get it, at least to the level that they want, by way of a meeting. In a way, the meeting itself is in the fact that we are even discussing having a meeting is a win for Kim.
Because it elevates him to our level.
Exactly. This is somebody who has been isolated, who has lashed out at other nations, threatened the South Koreans, threatened the Japanese.
Threatened us.
He's obviously threatened the United States. and his sort of it would be a coup for him to get a meeting with the president. Now, the president seems to think that he can sort of use his own skills, whether they're negotiating or sort of his charm, to maybe get a change in the North Koreans' behavior. That is the ultimate goal here, is denuclearization. Every time you talk to the White House, that's what they insist on. I look at this move, this pledge to say, you know, we're not going to hold as a condition by the North Koreans that Americans leave here, as a bit of a false olive branch, as a way of saying, look at us, we're willing to negotiate. But as Tom rightfully pointed out, it's not like the Americans were getting ready to go anywhere anytime soon anyway.
Well, the term denuclearize, what does that mean anyway? I mean, does it mean stopping their nuclear testing? Does it mean actually giving up their arsenal? Does it mean stopping missile testing? I mean, how's that term actually defined?
That's a very good question, and it's something I don't think the administration has, at least not publicly, defined. The problem is how far along is their program? We have a pretty good idea. I think our intelligence agencies and the intelligence community has a much better idea than the public does about how far along they are. And the question is exactly right. Is it getting rid entirely of nuclear weapons? Is Kim going to be willing to do that? You have to sort of game out at what point does Kim say, look, I've got nuclear weapons. I can do what I want, in a sense. And that was what makes me skeptical about where these talks are going to go if the ultimate point here, which is the United States wants to see a denuclearized, a North Korea regime without nuclear weapons. What could possibly convince Kim to do that, given what we already know, and probably he's much farther along, what we already know about where his program is?
Well, and beyond that, Tom, if you look at the fact that these North Koreans very carefully were watching this attack on Syria the other day, and it's sort of been said that he has to hang on to his nuclear weapons because that's kind of a security guarantee, as Michael said, against that kind of an attack by the United States or anybody else. I mean, Assad certainly has that does not have that kind of guarantee.
No, that's exactly right. I think the other thing, Michael's already talked about this, is that Kim's nuclear program is part of why Kim believes that he can get more international respect, and that the very fact that the president of the United States, ostensibly the leader of the free world, is willing to meet with Kim suggests that the fact that Kim has nuclear weapons enhances his stature. So I agree with Michael. I think Kim will want American nuclear weapons off the peninsula, and I think that would be very difficult for any president, even a Democratic president, to agree to. So we've got a long way to go here, but it is an intriguing story, that's for sure.
It's important to remember also, before we move on here, that these North Koreans have a long history of making promises that they have not fulfilled. Kim and his father and the first Kim Il-sung, in fact, the founder, so you've got to be quite skeptical of anything that they say. Well, moving on here, Cuba has a new leader, and for the first time in six decades, his name is not Castro. His name is Miguel Diaz-Canel, kind of a new leader, 57 years old, but he's said to be sort of a chip off the old Castro block. Isn't that right, Michael?
That's right. Born actually after the revolution, which is notable, and just goes to show you sort of how long the Castros held on to power. I mean, he doesn't have the last name Castro, but if you listen to what he said upon taking power in Cuba, we will remain faithful to the legacy of Fidel Castro and the example, bravery, and teachings of Raul Castro, the current leader of the revolutionary process. That's really all you need to know, I think, at this point, that there is, there is no sense of, say, de-Stalinization, any effort to put distance. Maybe we'll see that in the future. I wouldn't count on it. This is a regime that still believes, again, that the Castros are, as he said, the leaders of this revolution that's still ongoing. Let's wait and see. But I'm not optimistic that there's going to be much of a change, at least in the ideology of the Castro regime.
Well, these Castros came to power, I think, in 1959. So they've been, Tom, a thorn in the side of every American president since Dwight Eisenhower, and based on the quote that Michael just read, it doesn't sound like there's much reason for optimism here.
Well, Raul Castro is stepping down as president of the country, but he is going to maintain his position as leader of the Cuban Communist Party. So as long as Raul is physically on the scene, I don't think you're going to see any change in the ideological framework of Cuba. Now, we'll have to see whether there are baby steps along the way, maybe more cultural exchanges, maybe a little less harassing of medically harassing of American diplomats, whatever. But some of that may happen on the margins. But I think ultimately this is going to remain a communist state for the foreseeable future.
And just to give our listeners around the world kind of clarify all of this, former President Obama normalized relations with Cuba. President Trump has kind of taken a step back, a bit more, slightly more hostile towards this Cuban regime. Do you see that changing at all, Michael?
Probably not. I asked the White House what they thought of this latest power change. Didn't really hear anything new from what their standpoint is, which is very, very skeptical of this normalizing of relations. Of course, we remember the a few months ago these reports of loud, high-pitched noises affecting American diplomats there. This is a regime that is still hostile to the United States, very much so. And I get the sense that the Trump administration has no real interest in changing that until, again, the Castros and the Cubans change their behavior.
All right. Well, let's take a short break here. More issues in the news in just a moment.
Thanks for tuning in to Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download a free podcast, just click on the iTunes tab on our website, voanews.com. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel. Michael Warren, who is joining us for the first time from the Weekly Standard, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Our moderator is Paul Brandes, White House correspondent for West Wing Reports.
Welcome back. President Trump and the former director of the FBI, James Comey, continue to fight in public. They're insulting one another, belittling one another on TV, on social media. Trump fired Comey about a year ago. Now Comey has gotten even with the book. And now, Tom, there are these notes that Comey kept of his meetings, his conversations with Trump. Very careful notes, apparently, detailing these chats. What have we learned from them?
Well, one thing I thought that was a tantalizing tidbit was in one of these memos, Comey says the president was complaining about Michael Flynn, who his first national security advisor, who lasted 24 days before he was fired. And allegedly, President Trump said Flynn's got problems up here, pointing to the side of his head, meaning he's got judgment problems, I think is the exact phrase that Comey says the president used. And President Trump fired back and said now he's just trying to make somebody else miserable and ruin Michael Flynn's life. We haven't learned a whole lot more. These memos just buttress Comey's previous assertions under oath. And of course, friends of Comey say these memos done at the time contemporaneously are another example of how Comey's been telling the truth about Trump from the start. But you're right. I find this whole spectacle really kind of offensive and obnoxious. I mean, you've got a former head of the FBI who clearly feels aggrieved, saying things about the president looks like he goes to tanning booths because there's little white circles around his eyes and his hair looks a little orange. And the president of the United States refers, last week he referred to Comey as a slime ball, which in 50 years of covering the White House, I've never heard a president of the United States refer to anybody as a slime ball. And the other thing is that Comey has sworn to all of this under oath. So president's partisans say, well, he's a proven liar and a proven leaker, so he's probably still lying. But, you know, if he is, he could face a perjury charge for lying under oath. And I doubt that that's going to happen.
So sort of degrading to our political system then and how it looks to others and that sort of thing.
It looks like chaos in the American, to use the American vernacular, small ball. We ought to be worrying about other things. And, of course, we are worrying about other things, Syria and North Korea. But it's just kind of tawdry. The whole spectacle is tawdry.
Now, since we have listeners all over the world, I mean, just a little bit of background on Michael Flynn. I mean, he was the national security advisor for President Trump, as you say, for about 3 weeks. Now, Trump hired him, even though President Obama explicitly warned Trump. He fired him as well, and he warned then-President-elect Trump, stay away from this guy. You shouldn't hire him. And yet Trump did it anyway, right?
That's right. So Flynn was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and had been fired by President Obama for basically an internal intelligence dispute that Flynn was on the outs with the rest of Obama's administration. I think he was aggrieved by that. And some people you talk to who know Flynn say the judgment issues that even President Trump mentioned sort of started after that firing. He was very close, Flynn was, with Trump on the campaign. He was an advocate for him, a surrogate, spoke at the National Convention, the Republican National Convention, in a speech where the folks in the audience were chanting, "Lock her up," referring to Hillary Clinton, that he sort of helped to lead. He was very much seen as an ally of the president's, but had a lot of problems. After he left the federal government when President Obama fired him, he had taken on some clients as a private citizen that were, let's say, unsavory, and did not, and this is sort of where he gets tied in, Flynn gets tied in with the Mueller investigation, FBI investigation, having ties and financial ties and not disclosing them. That's sort of where he ends up. And all of the time, he's on the Trump campaign and then eventually on the Trump transition, picked to be National Security Advisor. So he comes into this position very much compromised.
And kind of to speed this up, we're leaving out the fact that he's pled guilty to some
felonies. That, yes.
Felonies, by the way, and he's looking potentially at some time in prison here. So that's who we're talking about. Why should the president care what James Comey thinks anyway?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question because sort of on the strict issue of the Mueller investigation, the president seems to believe that Comey's actions are what led to the creation of the Mueller investigation, that in fact his leaking of these memos that we now have, his leaking of these memos a little less than a year ago, are part of what led to the decision by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to appoint Special Counsel Robert Mueller, which has exploded what Comey describes the president calling a cloud in his memos, the cloud of the Russia investigation, that the Mueller appointment can be directly linked to Comey's sense that he needed to act because the president was acting improperly. And so President Trump's interest is in discrediting Comey and saying he's a liar, he's a leaker, he had it out for me from the beginning. I agree with Tom that the memos sort of reveal that and actually don't tell us much more than what Comey has already been saying publicly and had said under oath. They definitely buttress the argument.
A validation
of that. Some people look at them and say there's evidence here that shows that Comey was part of an effort out to get Trump, revealing that there was this dossier, this unverified claim that the Russians had information that was compromising and might want to try to compromise the president. But it's sort of this mess of information that I think ends up revealing that the president just simply doesn't like what Comey did and sort of traces so much of his own problems that he's facing with the Mueller investigation back to Comey.
Now, beyond that, Tom, we've known for a long time that Trump has been very worried about Comey and Robert Mueller and this sweeping investigation. But in the past week or so, he has a problem even much closer to home. And that, of course, is his longtime friend and lawyer Michael Cohen, who is in some hot water himself. And Trump seems even more worried about that than anything else, right?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, because that hits closer to home. I mean, Michael Cohen has described himself in the past as Trump's fixer. And there are allegations that he has done all sorts of things in the furtherance of candidate Trump and businessman Trump and now President Trump. And let's put it this way. People close to President Trump say they agree with you totally, Paul. They say the Michael Cohen piece of this saga is potentially far more dangerous to President Trump than Comey and all the rest of it. Because, I mean, to use the old American cliche, Michael Cohen knows where all the bodies are buried, and it's probably because
I hope you don't mean that literally.
No, I don't mean it literally, but I mean it. He's been involved in many, many things, taking care of the interests of Donald J. Trump, and who knows what all that is. But I think the whole prospect of Robert Mueller, the special prosecutor, having access to Michael Cohen's documents, tapes, recorded phone conversations. I think that has really kind of really disturbed President Trump more than anything else of late. And there's a lot of buzz in legal circles that Michael Cohen has some serious legal issues to contend with, and that the federal government had been investigating Cohen for months about alleged wire fraud, alleged mail fraud, alleged all sorts of things. And that's worrisome for the president.
Well, this is going to play out for quite some time, so right. I'm sure we'll be talking about that far into the future. Finally, in our remaining moments here, Barbara Bush has passed away. She was really an incredible woman. I mean, the wife of one president, the mother of another. That's only happened once before in American history, Abigail Adams, about 200 years ago. Now, those of us who had the pleasure of meeting her on several occasions, I know we both did, just a remarkable woman. So, Tom, I'll start with you. I mean, tell us quickly about Barbara Bush.
Well, she was a force of nature. She was the enforcer. Everybody thought that George W. Bush, before he was governor and president, was the family enforcer, and that might be true. But Barbara Bush was the, if he was the enforcer, she was the capo of this family. She saw her job as not just raising six children, but to be the advocate for her husband and to make sure that anybody she thought was doing something or saying something that wasn't good for him would be spoken to. And, I mean, she was tough. Yes, she wore pearls. She was incredibly gracious, incredibly nice and kind on a human level. But, you know, somebody once said, it doesn't matter how high in the Bush orbit you are. If you do something that Barbara Bush thinks is problematic for her husband, you will find her in your way. And she was tough. She was shrewd. She was very savvy. And millions of Americans will miss her.
You know, the term the enforcer, by the way, was coined by her own family. It's an affectionate term. It sounds maybe a negative connotation. But my sense of that was that what she always enforced were standards of decency and graciousness and behavior. Michael, your thoughts on Mrs. Bush?
She's the last of a sort of generation that was, I think, very common throughout American life and certainly American public life. A sort of WASP, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, very much from a well-respected family. But the values that come with that are something that I think is sort of lost in American culture and society these days. And she was a sort of last reminder of that. The values that you talked about that she sort of enforced within the Bush family was that loyalty to country, loyalty to something larger than yourself, and to your own family. She was very much criticized, I think, by sort of more modern folks for leaving school early and stopping her own career, such as we would call it these days, to raise a family. But she found this, of course, as being very much a value that she could add. And I think Americans sort of sense that she's the last of a generation that we've now lost.
And this presumption of that raising six children, one died quite young, unfortunately, that raising children and taking care of the household is not a career, I think is, in my view at least, false.
Couldn't agree with you more about that, Paul. I want to tell one quick story because it's the last time I ever saw her. I was very fortunate to see the Bushes 2 years ago in Houston, and we had a very nice chat. And President Bush was in a wheelchair. He's not doing well, as everybody knows. And Barbara Bush came in, and she was using a cane, and she said to me, "You know, neither one of us can walk a damn any longer, but there's nothing wrong with our brains," and that was quite true.
All right. We'll have to end it right there. Unfortunately, our thanks to two of Washington's best journalists, Michael Warren of The Weekly Standard, Tom DeFrank of National Journal. This program was produced by the Voice of America Current Affairs, our engineer, Justin Thwaites. I'm Paul Brandis of West Wing Reports. Thank you very much for listening.